Well, this has been quite a few days, but quite a retreat on focusing very specifically on our stories, on our identification, and how to drop our stories, how to lift our identification. So much was about exploring how we create the I, the me, the mine, our identities, our stories, through our stories, and how we can renounce them, and what happens when we do. You know, is it something actually that is worthwhile to follow? You know? So, and this is coming really pointing to the core of the teachings. The dropping our stories, lifting our identification, renouncing the I, the me, the mine is what means to awaken. This is very much the core of the teachings. And if we do awaken, if we can drop out of that stories, if we can drop the me, the mind, the I, if we can see through the delusion of it, then this is called awakening, nibbana, or the unconditioned. I have to say, in my early years of practice, when I heard about nibbana, the unconditioned, the awakening, enlightenment, I kind of puzzled what that means. And it sounded so much like everything stops and my life is a little emptied from everything. And I just couldn't quite get it, and it felt like there was some doubt about, do I really want this? Enlightenment? Turning out a bulb? Or what is that? Awakening. And is it something I actually want to achieve? I felt like I just want to get more happy. I was in a lot of suffering, so I wanted to get more happy. I could really relate to that, but I couldn't quite relate to awakening, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And it went on for quite a while, and I went to Asia to practice for unlimited time. And I went to a place with a teacher called Ajahn Mahabodhi. And he is not so much renowned in the West because he hasn't taught in the West. He actually died now. But he was a fellow practitioner of Ajahn Chah, who many of you might have heard of. And he was one of those masters who had very deep realization. And he was very revered in Thailand as one of the awakened ones. And he had done a very tough training. A very, very, very tough. He was a tough guy. Ajahn Chah, I think, was more of a mellow guy. But Ajahn Mahabodhi was a really tough guy. But when I met him, actually many monks told me, even Asian monks told me, they wouldn't go there because they were afraid of him. He was, I mean, the famous one. In family, you couldn't play with him, you know. He was very strict. But at the same time, when I entered his monastery, I was expecting a fierce guy, and I kind of found myself quite the opposite. I found myself very relaxed. Inwardly, even outwardly, I found. And so even he was known for being very fierce, I felt a lot of freedom in his presence. But still I was somehow grappling with this notion of nibbana, of freedom. And do I really want this? Not to be attached anymore to anything. So there was a side of me which wanted to be attached. No, I was longing for relationships, I was longing for having a better life, I was longing for this and that, and for love, and blah, blah, blah. I didn't want to get unattached, really. And there was this one time he came to the men and the women living separately, and these monasteries. And so he came down to the women and gave us teachings, which I didn't understand a word because it was he was speaking Thai and nobody translated. But I was somehow feeling his presence. And he was sitting there and chewing his beetle and spitting and laughing and telling a joke and then getting serious and was doing all these things. And the women were really very touched by him, very revering him and very engaged. And then he stood up and he walked away. And I saw him just walking away and I had a feeling of he was engaged, fully present, and the next moment he just let go and was at peace. And it might be a totally imagination on my side, but something struck me. This total ease, this total being at peace, the next moment, letting go, just went right into my heart, and I thought, yes, this I want. I want this. This total ease, this total freedom to engage and to disengage. To engage and disengage. Be touched and let go. So for me, it's still a kind of sensation, some kind of vibration maybe that lingers with me. And it's kind of drawing me there. Having a sense of an impression of what it means to be awake. So awakening is a state of inner being where we are no longer defined by anything, and yet we can embody anything. So there's an utter sense of freedom which we can realize. And we come to this place through seeing completely through the delusion or illusion of self. The self, and it's important to really understand the self, what we mean there is, we mean this felt sense of there is something that has, that belong, that has whatever, the body, the mind, the emotions, the possessions. The sense of these things belong to me, a core thing that exists. And that's going to stay. And it's unchangeable. It's separate from everything else. And it's important to actually get a sense of that, what we mean, this kind of experience. Because otherwise you might think what we have to get rid of is everything, the body, the mind, the emotions, the thoughts, and we just sit there in a blank nothingness. No, it's not meant. But it's this kind of notion of there being a fixed, unchanging, separate self. It's very obvious if you look a little closer and a little more, with a little more continuity, we discover what we call self is a process or is in process. It doesn't stay. We explored it this morning, how we go through childhood, we are born, and then we grow up and we move through life and the sense of who we are is changing. And it's very obvious that there is nothing that stayed, not even the body. Every cell is renewed since we are born. And the same with our emotions, our thoughts, our experiences, they keep changing who we think we are. There might be some things which seem to go on for a long time, but you haven't been there all the time. So if you look closer in our meditation, mindfulness reveals us. Self is a process. It comes to be and is also dissolving. We are not the only ones discovering this. The Buddhists are not the only ones saying that. Actually, a lot of scientists are saying the same, Western scientists. And not just since the last few years where they came into contact with Buddhists. That's actually quite a few hundred years back in the psychology, they had the theory, the bundle theory. So the bundle theory saying the self is existing of many parts. There's nothing that exists separately, in itself, as what it is. What we are, think we are is made up of different parts. Just the same. It's very similar idea. And interesting is that the discussion is still not finished amongst the scientists. They still try to grapple with this subjective notion of self. How it comes to be, where it's to be found, and how to speak about it. One person who is taking a lead at the moment is Antonio Damasio, so if you're interested reading around that. And he describes that the three levels where self comes into being. And he speaks of a proto-self and saying that's a very fundamental notion of self any being has. It's very crude, very primal. Even very primitive animal from the evolution side, primitive, have that. That's what he's saying. So basically, if you punch a worm, he might cringe. He might get a wave of whatever is attacking it. So that sense of something is attacking me, there must be a sense of duality. A very basic one. There's no thought, probably. Then he speaks about a core self. The core self being a notion of self arising in through the senses. Whenever we are getting aware of a sight, there is an object and a subject. Unless they fall into each other. But normally we perceive, I perceive the curtain, I perceive something, I hear something, I taste something. This kind of immediacy of experience, and yet there is a duality. That's what he calls a core self. And we do focus on that quite a bit in meditation, and we get an experience of that. There is an arising of a subject, and arising of me knowing an object. And he also, in the third level, he speaks of the narrative self. The narrative self is where we tell to ourselves our stories. Sorry about my English. We tell the story, we tell in our stories, we tell each other who we are. And that's a natural function of the mind. So I kind of found it quite interesting or quite relieved. Aha, that's why my mind is getting lost all the time. And all the time when I see, you know, where it's lost into, it's creating a story where I'm playing somewhat a part. It has something to do with me. It refers back to me. I think about this, that and that. It's either I'm in it or it's an opinion of mine or whatever. So this kind of way of thinking, which is happening whenever I don't have to focus on something, the mind falls back into this mode, creating a narrative self, telling oneself stories. And that's a natural function of the mind, the natural thing of the mind. So, it's interesting. In Buddhism, if you look at, in Buddhist terms at us, at this, we can also see, we had this, Stephen talked yesterday about the clinging, the clinging to certain parts of our being, clinging to our body, clinging to our feelings, clinging to our thoughts, clinging to our possessions, clinging to our experience. Through clinging is that self arising. And we can see that it's not just the story which is bringing out the self. You have to cling to it. You have to take it to be mine. We've seen the difference between I make it into my story or I listen to a story. So the clinging is a very important part of the self arising. We can have an experience, and we can actually, the subject and object can draw, and there's no one experiencing. We can have that experience. That's why the clinging suddenly disappears. Mindfulness is a function of the mind which can simply acknowledge what's happening, simply touch experience and let it be as it is. And through this mindfulness, we can look through our delusion. That's the whole point of using mindfulness. We can see how the self is arising. And by that very possibility, we can see through the delusion of the self existing. So that's the main aim we have. We can see that the experience of self arises out of a process. It might take quite a bit. First, we see it on the level of seeing different stories. See how they evolve over time, how they change, how we can drop one, how we add a new one. That gives us a hint of the self is a process. But if the mindfulness gets sharper, then we can see the self arising as an experience. Not just with the story, but also with the sense contact. Someone in a retreat in nature, he told me about this experience. There was a sound of the wind coming. And he knew when the wind would be coming, it would be getting cold. First would be the flush of wind, and then there would be coldness. And first I was simply noticing the wind, simply knowing the thought, and then came in the eye. I will be cold. And that made it suffer. So it was very interesting to see the sequence. So we're practicing in order to not just drop one particular story, get a little bit more happy, that's wonderful. But you want to go really to the core of the problem. The core of the problem is the arising and of this self which we think is a something, which is freezing experience, which is out of which we form these attachments and we lock ourselves in. And we want to see through this. Because once we have seen through it deeply, deep enough, then we won't fall into that trap again. There will still be experience arising, there will still be stories arising, but we no longer take them as me, as mine. And with this, suffering ceases. In the Dhammapada, it's a collection of verses by the Buddha, it's a wonderful lines. House builder, you are seen. You will not build a house again. All your rafters are broken. The ridge pole destroyed. Gone to the unformed, the mind has come to an end of craving. might have the end, we might have come to an end of suffering. The end of craving is where we put down the burden, any burden. We are extinguishing the fires Stephen talked about yesterday. And the fires being greed, hatred, and delusion. These fires which lead to suffering. We put out the fire. Or it's also likened to the cool shade we walk into out of the hot sun. And I think here's a good place to get a feeling what that means. Germany might not. You might rather want to go into the sun. But here you kind of, oh, luckily there's a tree with some shade. It's also likened to peace, to stillness, to freedom. There are many images for this, where we are lifted out of that selfing process, that clinging to this me, I, mine, and to the things connected with it. They're somehow burdening us. So, we come from different sides, and we often, because it's obvious, we come from the stories that do burden us, and we investigate it. Because it's so wonderful, if you investigate the stories that are burdening, that burden us, we feel like looking through it, seeing it's a process, they come and go, and we let go of them. But then we have to go a bit deeper. We have to look at the source, where that's coming from. Till we see, not just look at the stories as a focus, but look at the clinging as a focus. And anything we cling to is burdening. Anything which we cling to is limiting us. And whenever we don't cling, we get more light. Something we don't have to carry around. Neither the difficult experience, but also not the wonderful experiences. Of course we want to let go difficult experiences, but we want to hang on to the nice ones. These ones we want to cling to. But the problem is, soon as we cling, we get a little uptight. We might get a little anxious. They might go. Someone might take them. Things might change. And it will change. So we have to let go. Come back to that inner place of openness. If we let things unfold more and more and drop into this openness, you will see that the self will become more fluid, the first step. The first step of looking through the self is allowing the process of selfing to occur. It comes into being and disappears again. Comes into being, disappears again. Comes into being, disappears again. When the self becomes more fluid, we notice that we can choose. We have a more freedom in how to act, which self to become. And it's important that we look into that. That we really choose wisely how we act in the world. What kind of self are we manifesting in the world? It's a very, very important step. We want to act in a way that's causing peace, that's causing happiness, it's causing joy, that's causing not just for ourselves, but also for the other people. So in some sense, the creating even on one level could say a positive self. Dropping the unskillful ones, the harmful selves, and cultivating a positive sense of way of being. And it is a place for that. If you stop there, it's halfway. You have to go a little further. But it's an important step, especially for the ones of us who are not enlightened straight away. To be enlightened straight away means the positive qualities come spontaneously. In my experience, it seems like not quite a step. So we cultivate the positive selves and we rejoice in them. The Buddha asked us or encouraged us to rejoice in our positive qualities. And this lightens the heart, and by being lighter, we can let go more easily. Sometimes you have a feeling awakening is very far. Actually, it's very close. Awakening is very close. The Korean Zen master Shinoo said, awakening is easy and spontaneous. You don't have anything to do for that. It's amazing. But he also said, but even if you have awoken, then it may well happen that your familiar habits kick in easily. You have seen clearly what's going on, and the next moment you see yourself being in the same rut, just again. And it's interesting he said that. It somehow it's a relief. You might awaken, you might see through, and yet we see ourselves playing out the same thing again. So he said, awakening might happen easily, spontaneously, but you still have to practice. Because our habit energies are deeply engraved and we need a lifetime of practice to support our awakening, so we can actually manifest awakening. Whoever is right, I never know. You know, it seems like the Buddha awakened and no bad habits came back, but he seemed to have practiced for the rest of his life too. So the same was said with Mahabodha. He had this great awakening, was said, but he practiced to the end of his life. So all the ones I've been hearing of seem to have done that. So it might be good if we follow them, even if we haven't awakened. It's not just the bad habits that we're kicking back in, we have seen through. The really big challenge comes from the beliefs we don't see and take as truths. And we explore that a little bit. Or some states, some mind states seem so familiar that we don't question them. So we have to probe into our experience. And I also remember in Thailand, I had a long period where I felt like my insights into my habits were getting stronger and stronger, and I felt like I was kicking out a bad habit one after the other. It's kind of seeing through and letting go, seeing and letting through, seeing and letting go. I don't remember which ones. I can't be specific. But it was so interesting. I was kind of like going through a list and and crossing them out or taking them off, you say in English. And I thought, oh, done. I'm done. Oh, it's really going. But after a while, I noticed, oh, the same thing has come back in through the back door, just dressed a little different. I was kind of, oh. And it happened a few times with different ones. And then I thought, oh, maybe it's not a good idea to take off anything. Because as soon as I take off, I think I'm done, and I'm a little blind. I don't look anymore who's there. So I dropped doing that. It was very, very freeing, actually, not to think so much about where I am on the awakening ladder, but just to see what's going on. Is clinging arising? Is craving arising? Is selfing arising? Am I stuck in pride? Am I stuck in feeling low? Am I stuck in greed, in hatred, in whatever? What's going on? So with each time, but with each time of awakening, we do reduce our delusion, the force of being deluded. At any time we awaken to what's going on, any time we can see through the story, see through the selfing process, and see the illusion of self, of me and mine, open up and feel, experience the lightening of the heart and the freeing of the mind. We are reducing these forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. But I tell you, this thing has a downside. Really be sure you want to awake. It has a downside. You're going to lose something. You're going to lose the innocence you had before, where you could just plunge into greed, hatred, delusion, just full force and just be it. And no regret, no doubt. You could just go for it, what you want. You could just shout at someone else and just really go for the anger. And now it feels like, oh, wait a minute. It's like, ooh, it's not as pleasant as before. You know, so. But not just that. You might lose certain beliefs you were holding. Maybe about other people, who they are, whether they're good or bad. You know, like, if you belong, feel yourself belong and identify with a nation, and then there's other people who are bad, who are my enemies. And if you see through this delusion, suddenly you cannot quite as much as before identify yourself with the same beliefs. And suddenly you have a problem. You might not be able to say, yes, they are my enemies. You see them as people. You see how they are just like you. And you might lose a sense of belonging. You might be losing friends who are doing certain things. So, and I've heard that from practitioners, that suddenly, that was a big thing with the nations and enemies, but even the friends, you're not interested in the same things anymore. Going to pubs and getting drunk, you know, without any meaning, or speaking harshly and bad about other people, or whatever. There's starting something to shift in our lives, and suddenly we notice we don't fit into the same groups anymore. We're kind of losing something. And that's not always easy. So, you might want to get out of this. It might change the way you want to, your career, your profession. Suddenly you can't be this bank broker who's trying to get very rich by telling people a lot of stupid stuff, you know. So you might not be able to do all the things people sometimes do in this world because out of delusion, not knowing what they're doing, you might have to change. So, and some people around us are even getting angry at us if we don't behave in the way it's usually done. Yeah, living in a society, and there's some sort of social pressure to behave and think and act in a certain way. And if we look more with our wisdom eye, and we see, no, it's not correct, it's not right. It's deluded, it's full of greed and hatred, and we don't want to act like this. We kind of stopping them. And they don't like that being stopped and questioned. They want to go ahead. And we are in the way, and so they turn to us with their hatred. I just recently read a piece in Germany, actually, it was about a priest, a Jesuit priest living in Syria. He was from Holland. And he lived in Homs, which was getting bombed by, basically, with a lot of fighting from both sides. But he didn't take side. He didn't take side with the Christians or the Muslims. He was there for everyone, and he was trying to help everyone, you know, with medicine, medical care, giving shelter, giving food, and he didn't want to leave. And finally, someone went right up to him and killed him, specifically. You know, so, he was growing hatred towards himself because he didn't take side and soften like this. But interesting, at his funeral, all the parties were fighting against each other, who didn't talk for years, were standing there together and reunited in this grief for this person being killed. So it is not as easy. It's not just fun to wake up. It has a different side to it. We're looking through the games which are played, and stepping out of the game is freeing some, is really lightening the heart. But somehow we also find ourselves maybe in some way a little bit more on the edge. We don't have to stay at the edge. We can go into the middle. We don't have to separate ourselves. But we will see, we will find it difficult to join in the same way with everyone else. So awakening means I'm kind of slow here. Means that we're dropping things, patterns which are unskillful, and it's very relieving. And it's also meant much more radical, stopping believing in any creation of self. I spoke about the necessity, and maybe, not necessity, but maybe the that there's a place for generating a healthy sense of I. A sense of I, of being worthy of love, worthy of compassion, worthy of being, of taking place, of having a right to be here, just like this. That's a positive sense of self. And yet, when we step further in the to direction of awakening, we're looking through your sense of self as well. We want to stop believing any creation of self. And if we come to that level, it's very often that a lot of fear is arising. Fear of being extinguished. A lot of question, how can I function in this world if there's no self? But it's not that there is a kind of nothingness that's going to appear. What's going to happen is that we notice we are more than the small thing what thought we are. When we think of what we identify with, it's always just a little part of the universe. Instead of identifying with the small parts, we just open up to the whole universe. And we are whatever is manifesting in us. We can be everything. We are not limited anymore at all. It's this total freedom, total openness. It's likened to Indra's net, where we see each other, anyone manifesting a part of the universe, and we feel connected to it. It's like totally unbound, unlimited, vast. There's a greatness in that. And we don't need to be concerned anymore whether I manifest this or someone else. No problem. We really rejoice in the differences. It's not different from us, it's just a different expression of the same beauty, the same life. We're utterly connected underneath. There are different ways we can enter awakening. And for each one of us, it will be in a different way. And more than once, I would think. You know, sometimes you wait for the Big Bang experience and then that's done. But actually, what I think is more likely the case is we have many moments of awakening. Each time we see through the self, we awaken to the truth of non-self. Each time we feel we're opening into our being and feeling, dropping the sense of self and feeling just one with one another, we have a moment of awakening. And we might fall back to feeling separate. Okay, that's fine. But we will have another moment of awakening. So different gates, and there might be different ones we might encounter on our journey. There's one way, which is maybe the hardest one, is the gate of suffering. Suffering somehow brings us to, it somehow, if we can't escape anymore, we sometimes turn around and can drop the self, which is suffering. And there are different accounts of that. If you have read the story of Etty Hillesum, it's really much the story of encountering huge suffering and being able to let go of the self. And finding peace and amazing happiness and joy in the midst of the concentration camp. It's amazing to me. But that's the power of awakening. Another example, I just read in a magazine, Inquiring Mind. It's about a Palestinian journalist. I thought that might be fitting here. So he had an experience of being arrested by the police, Israel police, and being beaten up. He almost died. He was so close to death that he went out of his body, this out-of-body experience. Some people have a moment of dying and then reawake to life. And he's recounting his experience as, I was so much more in that moment of looking from above. I was so much more. I was the boot and the guard. The goat calling outside the walls of the police station. I was all of it. When I got out of jail, I couldn't take sides anymore. I married a Jewish woman and had Jewish-Palestinian children. That was my answer. So sometimes it's sad, and sometimes it's really so deep, it shifts, and we cannot take that self again. Sometimes it's an experience of selflessness, and that can be just by taking a step. And there's just walking, just stepping, or just seeing, just tasting. The duality of experience just falls away, and you feel a oneness. And if that is received in a very deep level, then the selfing doesn't come back in the same strong way. Just know we are everything. Even the duality comes back. It's very clear if you feel like, oh, this is one. Love is arising out of the heart. And there are other gates. There's the gate of service. Just serving someone else. If this is done out of your heart, it's a way of emptying the self. Some of you do it here. And it's something I noticed on my journey. I worked once in a Christian nunnery where there were a lot of old nuns who had served all their life working in a hospital. And some of them struck me as being so incredible light. It was just no self, not much of a self. They were so light, joyous, easy, and they had almost nothing in their rooms and worked all their life. They didn't have houses and cars and what we expect to have after work, you know, lifetime of work. You want to have something. You can say, yeah, that's what I worked for. They didn't. But they had a lot of lightness. There's the gate of joy, of sympathetic joy, of really rejoicing in the delights of others. It's a way of overcoming ourselves. If we really rejoice in the happiness, the success, and the ease of someone else, don't think about what's about me? What about me? Very often, you know, someone is having something nice, and you think, I like to. What about me? It's interesting. I read it once. Sympathetic joy being the path to awakening through joy. So if you want to do the light joyous route, you just develop sympathetic joy. Make that your practice. It's going to challenge you to really do it. But then it's a very joyous thing. Very joyous path. Of course, it's the gate of compassion. There's the gate of mindfulness. So there are many, many gates, many paths we can enter to. And sometimes awakening happens spontaneous without any practice at all, because it's unconditioned. We awaken to the unconditioned. We don't need a condition. And yet, it seems conditions help. There's these gates who prepare us, who direct us, who move us into realizing the unconditioned. Whenever we awaken, we embody our full potential of being. This full potential of being is unique in its expression. Sometimes you're also afraid, oh, if I drop the self, then I'm just like everyone else. Oh, I don't know, I'm not distinguishable anymore. And somehow a gray mess of being. It doesn't look like the monks of the Buddha's time who were renowned to be awake beings, they seem to be each one of them quite different after awakening. And the people, the few people I encountered who seem to be quite far on the road, quite awake, they're quite different from one another. Quite unexpected different. Not even that I could say, oh, he has to have this or that quality. Like Ajahn Mahabodhi, he was someone who would be quite fierce. He would shout. He would shout at you. He would be not a soft guy. You would expect anyone who is enlightened is a soft guy or woman. And you can do anything you want with them. Like someone's 7 o'clock in the morning at home, and you just wanted, not out of an emergency, just to chat. And I said, well, actually, I didn't have my coffee yet, and why are you calling anyway? He was kind of appalled that I was kind of not so happy. He thought, of course, he has to be happy. Okay, what? Why? So the expression of enlightenment can be quite different. Some are silent. Some don't say much at all. Some you won't recognize. Some are quite loud and outspoken. Some seem more a manifestation of love, and some others more of wisdom, of clarity. And awakening is not bound to Buddhism. I think we find awakened beings in any religion or no religion. And if you look deeply into the religions and the teachings there, we probably find awakening, enlightenment at the very heart. If we broke down into it. That originally it came out of enlightenment. There was a great awakening, a great clarity and a great compassion and teaching in the world. But as the mind, we all know, has a strong tendency to cling, later on it is made into something. Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, whatever it's called, and we cling to it and then we fight about it. We fight over it. Seems kind of odd. Even Buddhists can fight, you know. Don't think they are just all peaceful. Or have always in through all history. There are lots of fighting as well. So, teachings can get distorted everywhere. It's how the mind, when the mind is unenlightened, delusion comes in and might change it. So that's why you have to practice. That's why we have to practice ourselves. And that's why there is a Zen saying, if you see the Buddha, destroy it. What it really means is, don't cling at it. Don't cling. It's nothing holy. It's inside your heart, this is the freedom. Don't cling to anything. Well, the Buddha, he likened the Dharma to the raft. The raft you need to build to cross over a river. But when you get to the other shore, you leave the raft. And then you walk on. You don't take the raft on your shoulder and walk with the raft you don't need anymore over the land. You just let it stay there. So we use it to get over, but then we stop clinging. So, non-clinging. It's the main message. Don't cling. And you get to the other shore. And if you're there, don't cling. Wherever, don't cling. And you awaken in this moment. That's it, a few minutes.